welcome back to another edition of Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I am, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, training, conditioning, and winning hoops brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to all of our previous episodes anywhere you can access podcasts, as well as any of our episodes. That's coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And be sure to follow our brands on Twitter as well. That's at coach_AD, at train condition, at winning hoops. And then myself, as always, if you like, at Wesley Sykes _. And just one more housekeeping note before moving forward with our guest today. For those in the sports medicine profession looking to earn continuing education units, training conditioning does offer opportunities to earn those CEUs through reading our digital edition of each issue and then taking a short quiz on what you read and learned. So simply select the continuing education tab on training-conditioning.com and follow the connecting link to get started. Now that that's out of the way, today I'd like to welcome to the program Ken Sales, a decorated high school cross-country coach from California and author of the book Coach, Run, and Win. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us today, Ken. How are you?
It's my pleasure. Thank you. I'm doing great. Got the dog walked this morning and I'm ready to go.
Awesome. I love the step and repeat in the background for those who do a little audio and visual clips here too. I got a copy of the book here right next to my desk. Once again, the book is Coach, Run, and Win. But tell us a little bit about yourself, Ken. What drew you to coaching cross country?
Yes. I was a high school teacher for 34 years, but about 8 years in, a colleague of mine in the social science department at Capitol Valley High School was the head cross country and track coach, had an opening for an assistant coach, knew that I ran a lot. I eventually ran 23 marathons, qualified for Boston about 16 times, and so asked if I wanted to join in. That was in 1987. And so I spent a couple of years as an assistant to him and then took over as the head coach, and which I remained for over 30 years. It it worked well because I think good coaching is good teaching, or, you know, teaching is a form of coaching at, you know, back and forth. And as a excited runner and somebody who loved running and being able to then educate and motivate runners that I was then beginning to work with. So yeah, that's how it got started. Actually, I just saw him a couple of days ago. So it was really nice to catch up with him. He got me started in this.
So, and then what was the impetus behind, developing the book? And it was just ready to unload all those years of knowledge that you had picked up and wanted to share it with the world. And
yeah, that's kind of it. It was, over the years, it had some measurable success, which was great. And I would have often people say to me, you're so organized, you ought to write a book sometime. And I'd go, yeah, you know, people say that to you in lots of different professions, I'm sure. But in retirement from the classroom, I was still coaching for a while and then helping out actually part-time after I stepped down as the head coach. My first star runner is now the head coach. So I'm mentoring her, which is kind of fun. So a colleague, which had happened before, asked me to meet with him could he ask me questions? And, you've been doing really great. And, you know, could you tell me a little bit about how you're doing that, et cetera? So I made kind of a two-page outline, typical of me, and brought it to the meeting with him. He bought me a nice dinner and we chatted for a while. And then, so I had that. And then early in January of 2020, I thought, maybe I'm going to start trying to write this all down. And so when I got around to getting with a publisher, they asked me, what was your impetus? You know, you want to make money, you want to, have a legacy, et cetera. And I think it's certainly more the legacy. I'm not opposed to selling some books and making some money either, of course. but it was really more the legacy part. And I felt like writing this book kind of initially with the focus on helping coaches was really, it felt like I had a lot to lay out. There's a lot to know. I mean, some people just think, oh, you coach distance runners, tell them to go run and come back in an hour or something, right? It's, certainly the running part's much more complicated than that, but also administering a program and, dealing with administrators and parents And, you know, there's a lot to do, you know, scheduling buses, et cetera, et cetera. So the book is designed to help runners. You can read it if you're not a coach, certainly. I hope so. But certainly for a coach and particularly for your audience here, it kind of takes you through from start to finish, from the spring prior to the summer in through workouts and the fall and the awards banquet. We always say the season's not over till your banquet's over. So, and then getting ready for the track distance portion. So, it was kind of me unloading all of the lists I had made and spreadsheets I had made and stuff like that, kind of getting them organized into one place.
And that seems great, you know, from a reader's perspective, from a coach's perspective, if you're looking for a sample diagram guide of how to build a program, how to start a program, right? This is probably a good place to start.
I would hope so. Yes, I think so. Yes.
But like you said, you know, some people might think running is just telling students just to go run for an hour, right? And then come back. But I've always been fascinated by the strategy of cross country because, you know, it's an individual sport to a degree, but it is a team sport. There's team accumulation and points there. And, I'm just wondering of how do you convey that team aspect to your athletes there while also trying to get the best individual times?
Yes. I think there's two things. One, educating the scoring portion. Okay, you need five people to score, and you know, it doesn't have to, you know, you can win a meet without having the number one person, etc. So explain all that to them. Explain the importance of the fifth person. Often, most coaches know it's often that fifth person that's your key, or your four and five, and then even the six and seven. So emphasizing to them how much a team matters in the scoring. You can have the number one runner, but if you don't have anything behind that, then it doesn't matter as a team. Mm-hmm. And then the second part is, I think, establishing a culture of team through creating positive attitudes about the work. I like to tell the kids, I said, I'm not going to use the word easy about anything we do. Mm-hmm. Okay. What we do is hard. Going out for an hour run is hard. Doing, you know, 600s, 800s at race pace, that's hard. Running every day, that's hard. And so I wanted them to take pride in that. To be honest, there's a kind of a us versus them aspect then to it as well, where it's kind of like, okay, we're doing this together. You know, we just have the one thing we're doing. We're going to go out and we're all going to run, you know, maybe four different races, but we're going to go out and run the same distance and, you know, on the same day. And so creating a kind of a team attitude around the work ethic and, mm-hmm. and around the commitment to therefore each other, understanding that we need each other to do well as a team in spite of how an individual may do. So I think it's a combination of those things. At our really peak several years, 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, et cetera, I had a team one year where one of the local reporters, we were getting a lot of press. It was going extremely well, one of the top teams in the country. But we would often have a different person be our first person in each of the meets. And so this reporter, Jason Eichelberger from the Orange County Register at the time, he would say, you know, that interchangeable parts, he kind of came up with that. And he'd say, hey, another interchangeable parts day. And I go, yeah. And that felt really good. We weren't just relying on one person. And each of them knew they didn't have to do it alone or by themselves or didn't always have to be the first person, that somebody would step up. So I think, it's the combination of the education about the scoring as well as then the creating that kind of team work ethic support as well.
Yeah. And again, I think of, you know, the term home field advantage, home court advantage, right? That's usually in regards to fan bases when you're talking about football, basketball, baseball, but in running and cross country, I think that's a real advantage there that you can kind of have as a coach. You know, the dips, the dives, you know, the hills and everything, when to speed up, when to kind of get in a pack and that sort of thing. So how do you deploy that on the road? That sort of thought and knowing opponents' courses there, where that clearly is an advantage for the home team.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. When possible, you go to a course even before you run it. Now, that's a very ideal thing. You know, if it's a long ways away, if your transportation or bus situation doesn't allow for it, but I really, really liked the idea of practicing on a course when possible, or simulating that. So sometimes we would have pictures or video of a course that we weren't going to get to. And then talk the kids through. Okay, we go out on the grass at school and say, okay, here's what the start's like. Or we go to some hills nearby and say, we participate often at the famous Mount Sac Invitational, a very, very famous course, all these difficult hills in it and stuff like that. And so we had workouts that we called Mount Sac simulation workouts. Okay, we're going to run flat for a while really fast, then we're going to go up a hill. Okay, and that's what it's going to be like. So I think helping them helping the athletes to visualize the course and what to anticipate. And certainly if they've been on it before, then you can remind them of it again. But the advantage in racing on a course is not that it's yours or not yours, the disadvantage, but whether or not you're familiar with it. Our first meet of the season is always at a place nearby called Laguna Hills High School, Laguna Hills Invitational. And we would go practice there 4 or 5 times in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And we ran well there for a number of reasons. We had a lot of good runners, but in part, they would always say, "Hey, coach, it was so great that we practiced there because I wasn't nervous about the course and I knew where the hills were and I knew when to accelerate and speed up." So that's an important way to cut into a quote home course advantage if there might be one.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine, right? Because when you can kind of just turn the brain off and then rely on muscle memory and things like that, then you don't have to expend energy on thinking, do I go left or right here?
As in a lot of things and in a lot of sports, in execution, trying to have your brain shut off is a good thing.
Right. It doesn't sound like it when you say it out loud, but I get the logic behind it for sure. You had mentioned the degree of success that you had with the cross-country program throughout the number of years and number of fast runners that you have. When I was covering high school sports, and cross-country tend to be, not one of the core four sports there. And a lot of coaches were discussing about trying to figure out how to get their best athletes into a more niche sport. Is that something that you had to deal with at all? And if so, how do you kind of gain popularity in a niche sport like cross country?
It's a good question. And there's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. My first answer would be, well, if you manage to have a lot of success, then it attracts a lot of people to come to it. Well, duh. Okay. But I like the reference to how you deal with a core four, because we would have to emphasize, to our parents and stuff too, there's not going to be 5,000 people watching you, in a dual meet or something like that. Okay. We need to be our own audience, our own support system. But I think in particular, aside from the somewhat humorous but often accurate aspect, if you're having success, then that attracts some attention and gets some people to come out and certainly get some attention for your sport. And it's a very practical thing for new coaches is you got to use your announcement system at your school, whatever that may be, or your announcements not too long ago, but it was announcements in the morning, after the Pledge of Allegiance. And anytime any of our athletes or teams did anything, we put it on there. So they were hearing about cross country every day, and the kids, well, not every day, but several days a week, maybe. And the athletes were getting recognized often. Then I'd make sure I had a list that I'd rotate through that I could emphasize so that they were hearing their name on the announcements. And a lot of other sportsmen were doing that. And at some point we were, fortunately for us, for several years, the most successful program on the campus. And so that I think helped too, because I'd get introduced, someplace and go, Coach Sales cross country team, that's our most successful program on the campus. So it's a kind of one plays off the other. Obviously there's a chicken and egg. You will hopefully get some success, and then can play off of that. But you also need a good relationship with your AD, coach at AD, and your administration, so that they're willing to come out and see you and support you, to make sure that you get the good press that you deserve.
Yeah. And I think another aspect too, again, I'm thinking of the same school, the same cross country program. It must've been one of the first years that I was on the beat there, but they had a senior captain who was president of the student body, very charismatic, outgoing, likable kid. And again, wasn't kind of, they had eighth grade STEM students there as well. So the middle school was also there. That can also be a factor of intimidation and kind of welcoming younger students in there. And
yeah,
he said having that one specific person as the captain, how kind of did all the work for him, did all the advertising as a billboard. So, and was able to break down that wall of, intimidation by younger students as well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, having our captains it's explained in my book, but in California, the different states have different rules. But in California, we had some restrictions on certain times of the year when we could be meeting with the athletes. So mm-hmm. we had a period of time when our captains would start the summer without us. And that was good because then they established relationships with the newcomers. The newcomers weren't necessarily intimidated by being around us. Now, in some cases, we had fortunately some quite well-known individuals who were captains, but they were nice kids too. And mm-hmm. and you know, I'd instruct them about, you know, beforehand about, you know, make sure you're doing this, and make sure if you need to get your own workout in later, that people are staying with the newcomers and making them feel welcome, etc. That athlete part of it is a real key, I think, to successful programs is having mm-hmm. the athletes establishing those relationships and bringing Kim's kids in and making them feel welcome.
Now, as a novice, you know, recreational runner here, yeah. I have found myself through the years kind of shifting. I don't know if it's my gait, but how my feet land. I would tend to be more of a heel to toe type striker. Runner initially, yeah. But I've gone to more of like a mid to toe striker Great. Now.
Perfect.
And I'm wondering, is there a difference at all? Is there advantages, disadvantages to either, you know, concept?
Good question. Yes. You, basically, the ideal is that you're a midfoot striker. Heel striking tends to be create more injuries because and also slows you down. You're literally breaking yourself every time you do that. We have a drill that we do. I talk about it in the book early in the summer when I first meet with the athletes, where we have them run for a minute and they count how many times their right foot hits the ground. The ideal is about 90. Whether you're a high school runner, whether you're a great runner or not, whether you're an Olympian, the ideal is about 180 a minute, 90 on just the right foot, let's say. And then if they're well under that, they're probably a heel striker reaching out too far. So we work on ways to try to get them to give them some techniques to try to land more midfoot. If they have too many steps, then they're not covering enough ground. And so we give them some techniques about how to do that. But yeah, midfoot is key. And with a turnover of about 90, ideally.
And that just kind of happened organically through me through running on concrete through the city. And again, just kind of feeling that pain and that pressure that was shooting up good. Through my knees and everything. I was like, this doesn't good. Seem sustainable if I want to keep doing this through the rest of my life.
And you had a good instinct then.
Right, yeah. Something was telling me there, but is there any negativity with the calf or the Achilles there on being a more of a toe or mid striker?
Certainly the mid is about as injury free as you're going to be in terms of the stat causing it. Toe striking, yes. I see some runners in my neighborhood who are toe strikers, and I always want to, you know, play coach and go grab them. I don't, but I say, you know, I'm thinking, because you'll often see somebody who's a habitual toe striker has larger calves. Mm-hmm. And it's going to that calf muscle then pulls up on the Achilles. And I bet most toe strikers eventually end up with an Achilles strain because that calf is pulling up on that tendon and probably or some plantar fasciitis down there in the lower heel. Right.
Yeah. Cause I think I went from a heel to a toe and then found the mama bear the porridge right in the middle there right. with the mid strike. Yeah.
Yep. Good. Good for you.
All right. Well, that's good to know. That was enough for me here. I think we can end the podcast right now. No, I'm joking. but when you're preparing runners for a long season that may even extend over to the track and field season a couple months later, where do you draw the line between having them prepared and optimally ready and then, you know, going overboard and burning them out potentially?
Yeah. There's both an art and a science to that. Sure. I think, you know, it's probably not real complicated to say you need to have a good plan for how to do that. A year-long plan, certainly mm-hmm. high-level cross-country running. You want your distance runners then with you during the track season. So they're pretty much running all year. Now, in our case, I'd give them a couple of weeks off after the season. Many times for us, that was after our state meet in California, which was in late November, but then they'd get 2 or 3 weeks off where I really didn't want them to do much of anything. And then we'd start up again in early January, building up to the track season. The track season was over. In our case, our regional, it's called CIF competitions, and even the state meet in June. Then they get a couple of weeks off and start over. So 48 weeks, maybe 47 weeks of running, you know, that's a lot. And so you really have to have a plan about how to build that up. There are different theories and philosophies. I talk about it in the book about, you know, how much you're eventually focusing on or not. But one of the keys is you need to work backwards with your plan. You need to think, I think we can get to this place. I think, you know, whether that's just to your league finals or all the way to your state meet. And then you count backwards from there and then kind of portion out these different types of phases of working out so that there's a bit, you know, we'll simply put a kind of a buildup phase for 8 or 10 weeks where they're just kind of building up your mileage and your long run. And then you have several phases that follow where you're doing more specific types of work and speed work and so forth. But you also have to have rest days. You have to build in even rest weeks where maybe, you know, you built up 5 weeks and you know, you're at 50 miles a week and then you drop down to 40 for a week and then you go back up. And then you also, I think the second part of it, so there's the plan, there's the science part of it, but then the art part of it is having good communication with your athletes, having them feel like they can tell you, coach, I'm sore today. And establishing that that's okay. You're hoping to educate them and have a relationship where they're not just trying to get out of a workout, but you have to really learn the art of listening to and reading your athletes and know the ones who aren't going to tell you. And therefore you're going to have to watch and see, are they limping? You know, geez, what's going on, Susie? You know, you got to, you know, you're limping. What's going on here? So I think the two things, the plan and then the art through the communication part is really important, but you just can't send them out to work out hard all the time. They're going to die.
And I would imagine that you've been in this situation a time or two of having a high school athlete who's gone on to continue running at the collegiate level. And yep. I know we just recently published a piece on, you know, preparing those high school runners for that over, you know, progressive overload of the college schedule. And
yeah.
And just, can you speak to just how big of a leap that is and how do you prepare those college students?
Yes, I fortunately, it's a different this year, but I, as of last year, I could say I had 4 girls running at Division I Pac-12 schools.
Oh, wow.
And including right now, the current reigning Pac-12 champion, cross-country champion, Haley Herbert, was a state champion for us here in California. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I was conscious. Our program was not a big mileage program. We were not a low mileage program. We were sort of in the middle. There were some programs that were way bigger mileage programs who had more success at the high school level. But to be honest, I feel like their athletes sometimes when they went on to college were somewhat less likely to be successful percentage-wise because they'd maybe already run a lot, maybe too much even. So you have to watch for that. And it could be frustrating. You're thinking, you know, maybe if we, you know, add a couple of miles here and we add a, you know, a couple of 2-a-days here, then, you know, we'll do a little bit better and, you know, and so forth. But I think if you're creating a big picture, and I'm not trying to, you know, make myself look like this great guy about trying to nurture the kids, but I think part of it is if you're really doing this to help kids, then you got to be conscious of their overall health. And so then the second part is that, yeah, there is a leap in college. So I tried to think, where are we? So when some of these athletes move on, it's not a total shock to their system. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have kids who are doing well on 30 miles a week, then being asked to do 80, you know, a month or two later, you know, they'll get hurt that way. But with our 50 to 60 kind of peak area, moving on to doing 70 or 80, maybe at college, which would be typical, wasn't so much of a leap that you know, my athletes have gone on, especially recently, have done, you know, fine with that. And in the one case done very fine with it. So, right, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, I think physical conditioning, as you mentioned, is obviously of utmost importance when we talk about endurance sports. But I think mental conditioning is also very important there. And I think nothing more than just, I think in a personal experience, turning around from the gym to, because I forgot my headphones. You know, that's like that sort of mental, like not being able to do something without music. Obviously, that's not allowed in cross country events. Right. So, you know, how do you kind of build up, the mental conditioning of endurance athletes?
It's so important. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of chapters in the book about it. One is called Championship Mindset, which is kind of about an overall mindset that your coach and your athletes need to have about where we're going and really being mm-hmm. willing to risk and challenge yourself to do that. But then you need the specific tools almost day to day and race to race. And I think the first one, not shocking, is confidence. But how you get confidence in your athletes. And if I can, I'll briefly tell this story. I cover it in the book. I would tell this story. I say, listen, on our shoulder, we all have, in almost anything, but certainly in our sport, we have this little voice on our shoulder whispering in our ear saying, Ken, you can't run that fast. Wesley, slow down. You know, you're going to get hurt. You can't catch that girl. She's too good for you. You know, what are you trying to do? That voice is on there. It's always on there. Famous Olympian female Lynn Jennings once said she never did well in a race that she didn't want to quit halfway through. Mm-hmm. So you have to be on the edge, but you have to be able to have and I called it having an answer. You have to have an answer. And the answer is not to say shut up to that voice. The answer is to report the facts. I've done the workouts this week that indicate I can run this fast. I ran this fast last week, and therefore I can run that fast this week. Mm-hmm. I'm prepared to do this. I have a race plan that allow me to do it. And so having an answer, I call it, I think is a key to providing your confidence, and have that answer rooted in the facts, in rooting in what you have accomplished as a runner, and a racer. That helps you. And then I think goal setting, writing, I would have a goal setting session. We sit down, go over the race plan, go over the course. They write out their goals, you know, how fast they're going to run, where they think they're going to finish in the race. I would give them the information to help them with that. And then evaluate it afterwards. How'd it go? You know, what did you do well? What did you need to improve on? Mantras, having the things that you repeat to yourself, you know, Wesley, you can do this. Wesley, you can keep mm-hmm. going. You know, Ken, you're doing fine. You know, you can beat this girl, etc. So, and then I think we would do a visual race thing where I would take them through visually. There's science that shows that that actually has a physical benefit. If you mm-hmm. really focus and relax and pay attention to the cues, that visualizing, like we lying in bed at night before a race the next morning or something, all those things are helpful, but the mental part, yes, it's clearly a physical sport. Most sports are, but you can't push yourself through that second mile out where no one's cheering you, etc., and keep competing out there without some tools other than the fact that you've run a lot of miles.
Right. And that's where it comes into that difference between the individual sport, right, and the team sport mentality. I think in team sports, everything happens in a blink of an eye. And when it comes to cross country, it's just kind of you're stuck in your head for however long the race is. And it's that battle between yourself there, I think, for most.
Yes,
of the time,
exactly. Right? Exactly. You're right.
I love that there. And again, that's always why I got to have the music. I got to be able to drown it. Cause I won't win that battle against myself. You know, I guess I would. It'd just be the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Good for you.
We have one more segment here before let you go here. We call it five questions that have nothing to do with sports.
Okay.
So kind of a lightning round, light questions here. So you feel like you're mentally ready? You're physically prepared?
I'm ready to go. I'm focused. I have a plan.
Okay. Let's get going. I like it then. All right. Okay. What is the best concert that you've ever been to?
Oh yeah. The 7 times that I saw Bruce Springsteen.
Yes. My father, you'd get along well with my father-in-law.
I mean, my favorite band and music to listen to are the Eagles, but there's nothing like a Bruce Springsteen concert.
Oh, yeah. I got to imagine, too. The Eagles, too. Yeah. My father went to the first ever live performance of Elton John in the United States. It was actually, I think, Derek and the Dominoes were the concert, and then he just happened to be the opening act for it.
So
this year, my brother and I think we're going to try and get him Elton John tickets at Gillette Stadium in Massachusetts for Christmas there. So hopefully you can kind of bookend everything.
Yeah, sure.
You know, of course, Halloween right around the corner here. What is your favorite Halloween candy?
Oh, that's good. Probably M&M's. Plain
peanut M&M's, any specific or
plain? Yeah, plain M&M's. I don't. The color doesn't matter. Plain M&M's. I don't want any nuts messing with my chocolate. So.
Perfect. I like that. So I'm a peanut butter guy. So maybe
okay, there you go.
But the peanut butter guy, I like to mix with chocolate. So right, give me Reese's all day.
Reese's, of course. Yeah, there you go.
Also, sticking with the Halloween theme, do you have a favorite scary movie?
Yeah, scary movie in the suspenseful sense would be probably Wait Until Dark. It's an older movie, a blind woman being attacked in her house, etc. But yeah, that always comes to mind. Suspenseful more than scary.
I'm more of a suspenseful guy. Silence of the Lambs, that type of thing.
Oh, there you
psychological
go.
Okay. Thrillers, but the gore horror stuff, not for me either. I don't know.
No. And my lovely wife is not going to watch any of those anyway. So.
You'd be watching alone if so, right?
Yeah.
What is the best Halloween costume you've ever worn?
Oh, that's a good question. As a hardcore Jerry Seinfeld fan, we had a costume party where people had to come dressed as a Seinfeld character. And I was the maestro. So I had on a pair of boxers with no, you know, pants on then because they in the scene and they're hung up someplace and then a tuxedo top kind of thing. So, yeah.
I love it. With that coming back on Netflix, I love having a show to kind of like fall asleep to at the end of the night and then not have to watch the commercials in between. So
there you go.
I'm good happy point. That Netflix is back on there too. My dad is as well. So that's a great costume. I love it. What is the next vacation you would like to go on?
That's great. We are going to, for my wife's birthday in February, we're going to Hawaii. We have some family she does on Maui, and then we're going to Kauai and Honolulu. And then our 30th anniversary is in April, and we're going to start in Madrid and end up for the 30th anniversary in Paris. So we've got a couple of great trips coming up. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. 2022 is looking up for you. That's great.
The joys of being vaccinated and retired.
that's a beautiful thing. I'll be actually heading out your way around March for a buddy's wedding. I'll be a groomsman. I believe it's right around geez, I'm blanking on it now. I think it's around the Laguna Beach area, actually.
Oh, no kidding.
Santa Barbara area.
Yeah. Santa Barbara's north of us. But yeah, I live 5 miles from Laguna Beach.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm blanking on the name of it, the venue there, but very excited. It'll be my first time out to California. So
all right. Very good. That's
very
great.
Exciting.
Good for
and
you.
What I didn't realize, this just tells you the naivety that I have of the whole state, but my plan was, I was saying to my wife, I was like, let's spend a week out there. We'll rent a car and go up to San Francisco Sequoia National Forest, not realizing that's like a 12-hour drive. traveling three or four states in the Northeast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's not. Yeah. California is a big place. So yeah, you have to not make the, good for you.
Two separate trips out there. We're going to the Northern California next time.
There you go. That's good. Cause you don't want to have to rush through it. Yeah. There's a lot of great things.
Rent
to see.
A car, go on the Pacific Coast Highway, kind of do some of the good tourist stuff. I'm excited to do all that.
There you go. Good for you. That's great.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're going to have a great time. I know you said going to Madrid, you're not going to Pamplona. You're going to do the running of the bulls. You're going to check that out.
No, not that, but going into Madrid for a bit and then up to San Sebastian in the Basque country and into Bordeaux in the wine country and then on to Paris. So. Yeah.
Can't beat that. That sounds like a vacation worth remembering there. Well,
yes, good.
You successfully survived five questions nothing to do with sports. So congratulations to you. And again, thank you, Ken, for taking the time out to speak with us today.
You're welcome.
If you can, one more time for us, what is the name of the book and where can people get in touch with you on social media or anything like that?
Sure. I'm glad you asked. Good. Yeah, I'm on social media, but the book is Coach Run Win. By me, Ken Sales, and you can check it out. You can buy it from www.coachrunwin.com. It's available there. It's also available in eBooks right now at all of your retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and will be in bookstores starting in January when the publisher releases in the bookstores. But yeah, www.coachrunwin.com, and you can certainly get one there. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Good. So thank you for taking the time out here today. And again, you can follow all of our brands on Twitter here at coach_AD, at train condition, at Winning Hoops, and then myself, as always, if you like, at Wesley Sykes _. And again, you'll be wanting to follow those accounts to get a first look at who our next guest will be. But until then, sports fans, my name is Wesley Sykes, and thank you for listening to another edition of Sideline Sessions. And thank you, Ken.
Thank you.